There's a moment that every leader knows, though few can name it precisely, that something happens. It happens when a conversation goes sideways, or maybe a decision as a leader gets undermined. A colleague could say something that lands wrong. Maybe even some circumstances arise that you didn't choose and, frankly, you didn't want. And in the fraction of a second that follows, something takes over. Not a decision, but a reaction. It's something automatic. It feels preloaded. And it's when you seem to be running on a script that was written long before the moment got here. And afterward, if you're honest, you wonder, was that actually me saying what I said? Or was it something responding through me? Something, maybe something formed by old experiences, old wounds, old habits. Something that doesn't necessarily reflect the person you've decided to be. And the distance between those two things, the automatic reaction and the chosen response, isn't just a psychological phenomenon. It really is the territory where genuine leadership is either built or forfeited. And learning to live in that distance, to expand it, to operate from within it rather than collapsing it in a moment of impulse, is the most foundational leadership skill there is. And that is what this episode is about. And it's all right here, right now, and only on the Five Gifts Podcast. You're listening to the Five Gifts Podcast, a weekly show designed to equip leaders in the Spirit-filled church. I'm Bruce Ritter, and along with my co-host, Charles Russell, we offer insights for leading the local church in the fullest expression of Jesus. If you're interested in learning more about practical theology, the gifts of the Spirit, and spiritual disciplines, this is the show for you. Welcome to the Five Gifts Podcast.
Welcome back to the Five Gifts Podcast. I'm Charles Russell, alongside my co-host, Bruce Ritter, and this is episode 3. It's called The Power of Proactivity. What a joy it is, and we're so honored and thankful that you've joined with us today on the Five Gifts Podcast. Got a great episode lined up, and we can't get started until we say, Bruce, how are you doing? Got to check in with Bruce Ritter today.
Well, we're doing good, Charles. We finished up our in-person instruction for the first year of our cohort just this past Friday, and man, a little bittersweet, to be honest. This has been so life-giving to be part of it and to lead it, and I think it's been rewarding for our students. They still got a lot of work to do in terms of their writing, but imagine that these students have been working on their master's degree, and just 11 months ago, they weren't anywhere near their master's degree. Now they're candidates and about to reach for that brass ring. So Charles, has been an exciting few days for us. I've been celebrating a couple of birthdays. My daughter had a birthday. Just went to visit a friend over the weekend. I want to shout out to Webb Hoggard, one of our devoted listeners. Happy birthday, Webb. I hope your 40th was fantastic. But here we are again. It's Monday, a little later in the day than we normally film our episodes and record, but I'm excited to talk about this today, Charles. How about you? How's your weekend?
Well, I mean, not nearly as much cake as you got to enjoy, but a great weekend nonetheless. Yeah, absolutely. We spent Saturday night or Saturday evening. We're up here on top of the mountain, and so we had the fire pit and some s'mores and great sunset. So we just had a good night on Saturday evening. Great day at church yesterday, and then here we are now. So man, it just keeps. Keeps on getting better, so we're just stacking those days, man. And so with all that, I mean, I think we're in a good place to get going with our topic, our episode for today.
Yeah, we've been building the series in a pretty deliberate sequence. Episode 1, we started talking about, you know, these internal foundations that are important to the leader that you're becoming. And episode 1 established the governing premise that a real lasting transformation follows an inside-out process. It doesn't go any other direction. It's always inside-out. It begins with character your paradigms that you begin to look at the world around you. You look at your context. We talked about motives and kind of work from outward, or whether work from the inside, again, outward there. And really, there's no technique or system or strategy that can compensate for an unstable interior foundation. I believe last week we went deeper into the specific mechanism that makes transformation possible, or in some cases, impossible. Again, talking about those mental maps, again, those paradigms that we look through and interpret the things that we see. We talked about the social mirror. We're going to talk about that a little bit more today. That fixed growth orientations toward potential, and what we might call the Pygmalion effect, the way our deepest desires about others can shape what we expect and elicit from them.
Well, we've covered a lot of ground in the last few weeks, and so today we're going to press on, and as we arrive at what might be the most practically significant concept in this entire series, and that's proactivity. Not in the motivational sense, you know, the encouragement to take initiative, to be a self-starter, to move beyond, or to move before you're pushed, but in a more precise and maybe even more demanding sense. Things like the capacity to choose your response, regardless of what is happening around you. Even the freedom that exists in the gap between stimulus and response, and then the discipline of learning how to live there. So we're going to cover the deterministic maps that keep most people from ever accessing that kind of freedom. The most powerful demonstration of it in human history, the four endowments that make it possible, what proactivity actually looks like in the language and decisions of daily leadership life, and then how to begin developing this capacity systematically rather than accidentally.
Yeah, and before we can talk about proactivity as a discipline, we have to name what it stands in the way of, or rather what stands in the way of it, because the obstacle is not primarily a lack of motivation or effort. It's something that's more structural, again, a set of maps that most people have been navigating for so long that they experience them as simply, for lack of a better phrase, just simply the way things are. So let's talk about determinism, some deterministic factors and maps that make up what we call the social mirror. We introduced the social mirror, I believe, in previous episodes. And really, those are the accumulated reflections that we receive from the people around us throughout our lives. And we get them in so many ways, from assessments and projections that other people make on us, narratives that people have handed us about who we are and what we're capable of. Most people accept the social mirror as reality rather than, I think, recognizing it as one particular, always partial. It's a never complete image. It's often a frequently distorted interpretation of the reality that truthfully is far richer and more complex than any reflection alone can capture. Now, the problem with the social mirror runs deeper than the inaccuracy it can show us. When we accept it uncritically, I think we tend to accept a fundamentally deterministic account of our personhood. We're saying, in effect, that what we are is the byproduct of what's happened to us and what others have concluded about us, that we're shaped by forces that we did not choose and can't significantly alter, and that the past has the final word on the present. Now, that's very important because the more powerful those definitions, the more compelling that image is that you accept, can be a tremendously limiting factor in your own growth. And that determinism shows up in three specific forms. And I believe most leaders operate from at least one of them without fully recognizing it. And the first is probably a familiar term you've heard of. It's called genetic determinism. That's the belief that your character, your temperament, your limitations are essentially fixed by some kind of inheritance. In other words, you might say, I've always been this way. My family has always been this way. Kind of the scorpion and the frog, you know, it's in my nature. This is what I do. And so the map, again, that kind of map hands authorship of your inner life to DNA, the factors that were formative in your life. And even those ancestors who are not in the room, you can't even argue with them. So that's what we call genetic determinism. The second is, I don't want you to get the definition mixed up here. It's going to sound really woo-woo, but it's what we call psychic determinism. That's the belief that you have some emotional scripting, for lack of a better word. It's formed by your earliest experiences of reward, punishment, approval, rejection. Those things that determine your responses. And the leader who cannot give critical feedback because some of the early experiences encoded the message that you believe about yourself, well, that conflict is dangerous. And the person who cannot receive affirmation without deflecting because some early experiences made being a vulnerable person feel kind of unsafe. Listen, those are real patterns. And that deterministic map gives you the feel that whatever is psychically deterministic from those circumstances in your life, it can feel permanent. And so it's important to remember, though, that the inside-out approach says that they're not permanent. These are things that we can overcome. A third factor in determinism is what we may call environmental determinism. And that really is the belief that your circumstances are responsible for your outcomes. Like you might have the difficult colleague, the underfunded organization, the unsupportive leadership above you, the economy, the culture, the size of your church. These are real factors, and they do have genuine influence. The deterministic gap, however, or rather map, will say, It's a final authority. But again, the inside-out approach says that final authority belongs somewhere else entirely. So, Charles, all three of these maps, they produce the same outcome. Usually it's a leader who experiences themselves as primarily a product of forces outside of their control, who waits for circumstances to change before changing their own responses, who has, in effect, given authorship of their interior life to external factors, and who experiences a kind of helplessness that no productivity system or even leadership technique can actually address, because the problem is not at the level of technique. Again, it's an inside-out process.
As powerful as those deterministic maps can be, there's an even greater power that we have to overcome and not be overly influenced by them. It has to do with your freedom to choose. Commercial pilots are trained for one of the most dangerous conditions they can face, flying through dense clouds. When visibility disappears, something unsettling happens. A pilot's senses can begin to betray them. They may feel like the aircraft is climbing when it's actually descending, or they may even believe they are flying level when they're actually banking sharply toward the ground. The body is convinced it knows the truth, but the body is wrong. That's why pilots spend countless hours learning a discipline that can save their lives. They're taught to trust the instruments over their instincts. The storm may surround them, the clouds may hide every landmark, turbulence may shake the aircraft from side to side. None of that changes the fundamental choice before them. Will they surrender to the confusion of the moment, or will they deliberately trust what is true? The weather controls their environment, but it does not control their response. You see, a skilled pilot can't command the clouds to part or the storm to stop, but he has a powerful freedom. He can choose where he fixes his attention. He can choose whether fear will fly the airplane or whether truth will. And that's more than an aviation lesson. It's a picture of the freedom that we have in life. You see, life has a way of surrounding us with clouds. Things like disappointment, loss, criticism, failure, unexpected suffering. And even in those moments, our emotions often tell us stories that are not true. They tell us we are defeated, we're abandoned, we're trapped, or even that our circumstances have already determined who we will become. But human beings possess a remarkable capacity. We can step back from our immediate experience. We can examine what we're feeling without being ruled by it. We can choose to orient our lives around convictions rather than impulses, values rather than circumstances, and truth rather than fear. Spiritual formation is, in many ways, is learning to fly by the right instruments. It's learning that circumstances are real, but they are not ultimate. So emotions are important, but they're not infallible. The storm may shape the environment around us, but it doesn't have the final word about the kind of person we become. If a pilot can learn to trust the instruments when every instinct is telling him otherwise, then you and I can learn to anchor ourselves in deeper truths when life disappears into the clouds.
That's really well said, Charles. The pilot's response is a way of dealing with some of those factors that we think of in terms of our leadership when we encounter difficulty. Instead of defaulting to some of those maps, rather than leaning into those, we should lean into some other freedoms that we have, or we might even call them endowments, those capacities that are within us to respond to some external stimuli. And I think understanding them is a prerequisite to develop them. Now, the first endowment that I would talk about is self-awareness. That's the capacity to stand apart from your own processes, especially your mental thought processes, and observe them. It's to notice that you're angry rather than simply being anger. In other words, you have an emotional response. That emotion is not who you are. It's something you feel. To recognize that you're operating from a particular paradigm rather than simply living inside it as if it were reality. You know, most people experience their thoughts and feelings as immediate reality because they're powerful. They tend you to bring you into those moments where you feel like this is reality. And while most people experience that just as simply as what's true right now, self-awareness creates distance that makes examination possible. And I think examination is the first step toward exercising your freedom. A second endowment is imagination. Now, that's the capacity to create in your mind a reality that does not yet exist in your circumstances. That's to envision the person you want to become before you have become them. You to hold a picture of response that you want to practice before the situation will require it has arrived. So leaders use it to develop, you know, to rehearse in the imagination the responses that their current conditioning wouldn't produce automatically until those responses become more natural than the conditioned ones. A third one is the endowment of your conscience, the internal sense of what's right and true and what aligns with the principles that you have examined and chosen to live by, independent of what is convenient or socially approved in any given moment. Conscience really is the compass that keeps proactivity from becoming mere willfulness. It's what distinguishes a person who chooses their response from a person who is simply impulsive in a more deliberate direction. The leader whose choices are anchored in conscience really becomes the leader whose integrity holds under pressure, because the standard they're measuring themselves against is not external approval, but it is that internal alignment. And I would say the fourth gift that you have when it comes to exercising your freedom is independent will. That's the capacity to act from your self-awareness, your imagination, your conscience, even when every other force in the situation is pulling you toward a different response. This is really the endowment that closes the gap between knowing what you should do and actually doing it. It's the gap between the person you've decided to be and the person you are in a difficult moment. And it's not willpower in that white-knuckled sense. It really is the exercised authority or capacity, rather, of a person whose character has been developed enough to hold the line when circumstances can make it costly. So these are four gifts, four endowments that you have And they're not equally developed in everyone. They are capacities. And like every capacity, they grow through use and they atrophy through neglect. The discipline of proactivity is at its core the practice of developing these systematically, again, through the daily choices that either strengthen them or allow them to weaken.
Well, you know, with these endowments now as the foundation, we can begin to be precise about what proactivity actually means in the practical life of a leader. Because the word is used so loosely in leadership culture that it has lost a lot of its actual content. So proactivity, in its precise meaning, is the realization that you are responsible, not just capable of responding, are responsible for your response. That the quality of your leadership, your relationships, your inner life, it's not primarily a function of what happens to you, but of what you do with what happens to you. That your life is a product of conscious choices made from values rather than automatic reactions driven by feelings and conditioning. The metaphor of carrying your own weather is useful here. So reactive people are driven by the social weather around them. when circumstances are favorable, you know, when they're treated well, when the environment's supportive, when the conditions cooperate, they perform. But when the weather turns, now all of a sudden they face criticism, difficulty, or people maybe who don't treat them well. Well, now they become defensive, protective, and diminished. The social weather determines the quality of their inner climate. Proactive people care their own weather. Their inner climate is not primarily determined by the conditions outside of them. It's determined by the values and principles they've internalized and chosen to live from. Eleanor Roosevelt's observation is precise here. No one can hurt you without your consent. Not because hurtful things do not happen, but because the meaning you assign to them and the response you choose in the face of them remains yours. This doesn't mean emotional suppression. It doesn't mean performing contentment in the face of genuine pain. It does mean refusing to outsource your inner life to your circumstances. It means maintaining the authorship of your responses even when you can't control the stimuli that precedes them. So one of the clearest indicators of where a person sits on the reactive to proactive spectrum is their language. Reactive language functions as a form of slow programming into powerlessness. So for example, he makes me so mad. Well, you know, that sentence repeated and believed empowers another person to be the author of your emotional state. I have to do this. You know, that sentence over time produces a person who experiences their entire life as obligation rather than choice. Well, there's just nothing I can do. And that sentence closes the very gap that Frankl kept open in a concentration camp. It's the same for the pilot in threatening weather conditions, and it's the gift that a pastor has when dealing with painful conflicts in the local church. Proactive language runs in the other direction. I choose how I respond to this. I will. Let us look at what is available to us. These are not just more optimistic formulations. They're different maps. They're maps that locate agency in the person rather than in the circumstances. And maps, just like we established in episode 2, shape what we see and therefore shape what we do. Now, love is the most important example here. In the personality ethic framework, love is a feeling, something that happens to you, something you either have to have or do not have, something that can be lost and cannot be recovered by choice. But in the character ethic, love is a verb. It's a set of actions. It's listening, serving, sacrificing, it's affirming. That can be chosen regardless of whether the feeling currently accompanies them. The proactive approach to a relationship where the feeling has diminished is not to wait for the feeling to return before engaging in the actions. It is to engage in the actions and create the conditions in which the feeling can be restored. You choose to love before you feel like loving. And that choice is not a performance. It's the exercise of independent will in the service of something you have decided matters more than your momentary emotional state.
Oh, Charles, what a powerful contrast there. The the love, the idea of love that comes out of a personality ethic. Man, the character ethic where love is a verb, what just a fantastic statement there. You know, really the final practical dimension of our proactivity is a question of how we allocate resources. In other words, where you invest that finite energy that you have available in any given day, any given season of life. And here, the inside-out approach becomes immediately actionable. Every situation that you face can be mapped onto two concentric circles. You might think of the outer circle as the circle of concern. And the circle of concern contains everything that affects you and that you care about. The economy, other people's behavior, your organizational history. These decisions being made above you. It can include the culture around you. Again, these are real. They matter. And most of them are largely outside of your direct control. So that's the outer circle, the circle of concern. The inner circle is the circle of influence. And that contains everything that can actually affect you. That's your own responses, your habits, your choices. That's the quality of your work and your relationships. That's your character. It's the way you show up to lead, the way you show up to get the work done. It's the way you show up for people. The specific contributions, your position to make. And the circle is smaller than the circle of concern. But understand, this is where your actual agency lives. Reactive leaders are going to invest their energy in the circle of concern. They spend their focus analyzing what others are doing wrong, worrying about factors they cannot control, and building cases for why their circumstances are responsible for their outcomes. And here's the precise and predictable consequence of that investment. The circle of influence actually shrinks because the energy they could have been building genuine capacity and genuine influence is being consumed by futility and helplessness about the things that are outside your reach. Now, proactive leaders invest their energy in the circle of influence. They're not indifferent to the circle of concern. They're simply disciplined about where they direct their effort. They focus on what they can actually impact. And the consequences of that investment are equally precise. The circle of influence expands because genuine investment in what you can control builds the character, it builds your credibility, and it builds your capacity that eventually extends your reach into areas that were previously beyond it. Now, the diagnostic that makes this operational is the one we keep returning to throughout this series. Whenever you find yourself thinking that the problem is out there in the difficult colleague, the unsupportive organization, the size of your church, the impossible circumstance, notice that thought. Not to dismiss the difficulty, but to recognize that as long as the problem is located entirely outside of you, then the solution is outside of you. And you will wait indefinitely for a change that only you can make. The inside-out move is to ask a simple question. Given everything I can't control about this situation, what's within my reach? What response is available to me that genuinely is mine to make? And then invest your energy there. Charles, I'm thinking about a passage of scripture we just read from the message. The idea where the Apostle Paul in Ephesians 4 says, run, walk. And then he catches himself. He says, in fact, don't walk, run. Run the race that's before you to accomplish. I would encourage all our listeners on this point. Make sure that you're investing your energy in the things you can control. Not because you've stopped caring about the rest of it, but because you've decided that your energy is too valuable, it's too costly to spend on territory that really is not yours. It's outside of your control. So make sure that you're spending energy on the circle of influence rather than the circle of concern.
Yeah, absolutely. I couldn't agree anymore. So let me just close with something practical and something personal, if I can. The practical first, a 30-day discipline built around three specific commitments, not as a program to complete, but really as a laboratory for delivering the capacity that we've been describing. So for the first week, monitor your language without correcting it. Just listen. Notice every time, or notice every instant, rather, of reactive framing. Every "I can't," or every "I have to," every "he or she makes me," or every there's just nothing I can do. Write it down if it helps, but you can't examine what you've never looked at directly. So the language audit will show you with more clarity, probably than almost anything else, where you're currently locating agency. Then for the second and third weeks, identify one recurring situation where your conditioning runs faster than your choice. A specific context, a specific relationship, a specific kind of pressure where you're consistently, you respond from impulse rather than from values. So before that situation arrives again, spend some time in the gap. Imagine the situation in detail. Imagine a response that comes from your conscience and your independent will rather than from your conditioning. Practice it in your imagination before you need it in reality. Because the gap is a muscle, and it's built in the moments before it's tested, not only in the moments when it's required. Then for the full 30 days, make one small specific commitment to yourself each week and keep it. Not a large commitment, a small one, chosen deliberately and honored completely. Because the capacity to keep a large promise is built by the repeated practice of keeping small ones. And a leader who can't keep promises to themselves will eventually struggle to keep them to others.
Yeah, and here's a question from this episode that I think it's worth sitting with and thinking through it, be intentional about it. Before you move on to the next thing, where in your life are you currently giving the authorship of your responses to something outside of yourself? Not because you chose to, but because the deterministic map has been running for so long and so quietly that it can feel simply like the way things are. Remember, the gap between stimulus and response is always there. It's available to you wherever you are. The question is not whether you have it, the question is whether you're going to learn to live in it. And that's the work of proactivity. And it's the foundation on which every other development in this series is going to be built.
Absolutely. If you want a guide for this process, if you want to engage the interior work of leadership with someone walking alongside you, then connect with us at charlesrusselltraining.com, charlesrussellministries.com, Bruce is at coachingcardia.com. We would love to journey with you in this process. We offer spiritual life coaching, leadership development for people who are ready to stop being passengers in a script someone else wrote and start becoming the architect of your own character in life. Well, next episode, we move from the power of proactivity to the power of vision, what it means to begin with the end in mind, to orient every decision and every investment of energy toward a clear, examined, values-driven picture of what you ultimately want your life to have been. Because the proactive capacity we have been building today needs a direction to move in. And that direction has to be chosen clearly, specifically, and with full awareness of what it will cost and what it will mean. So we'll see you next time right here on the Five Gifts Podcast.
You've been listening to the Five Gifts Podcast. If you would like to take the next step as a spiritual leader, we invite you to visit either of our websites or contact us for leadership coaching. We can help you reach the next level in your own growth and leadership. We provide leadership, spiritual gift, and personality assessments that give you a better grasp of your leadership style. And we also create a customized growth plan that empowers you to reach your full kingdom potential. We can't wait to hear from you.